The Dave Dameshek Football Program. Available on Apple Podcasts and at NFL.com/DDFP. Now here's your host, Dave Dameshek.
All right, here he is. This is an interview I've been looking forward to for a month because about a month ago, I was contacted by Hollywood star. And, you know, as in TV, yes, the people on camera are stars, but it's really the person who creates the show. This is, as opposed to the way media works, where the producer is more relevant, it's the writer. That's the star of everything. And I am seated across from the guy who contacted me to participate foolishly in his program, Scorpion, on Monday nights on CBS, 9 p.m. Eastern.
10 p.m.
I keep saying 9 p.m.
You're the worst.
I'm not the worst.
I'm going back into editing. You're out of the episode.
It was 10 p.m. It's 10. It remains 10 p.m. Eastern. I've already put it out on social media. That was 9
a.m. Oh, you're the worst.
All right. It's 10 p.m. So what? So they'll watch whatever procedure.
Can you fix your social media? We got a couple of comedies before us. But I'd really rather them tune in at 10 and actually watch our show.
All right. Here he is, everybody. You hear his voice already. It's Nick Santoro. What's the poop, fella?
What's up, Double D? How are you?
See, I'm already getting dewy on my brow because I screwed up already in front of Hollywood power player Nick Santoro. But it's only up from here.
That's all right.
Santoro, one of my favorite guys that I've met since I got out here almost 20 years ago, which is weird.
But I only met you about 10, 11 years ago.
Yes, in the ongoing, and it's taken on a bit of legend, I feel like. 18, 19 years ago, when I first got out here, I started on a cable sports trivia show, and a guy named Sal was another one of the writers. I walked into the room, by the way.
Right.
I thought, this is perfect. I get staffed on this show. I've been out here for 5 months in Los Angeles trying to make my way, trying to get a writing gig. I get one. It's a sports trivia show on Fox Sports. I think this is the perfect
wheelhouse. Land.
Well, I feel like I'm going to kill because first I get a credit. They are saying we want this to be a funny trivia show. So I'm thinking, well, within the constraints of a trivia show, maybe I'll get in a few good wisecracks. Someone will take note and I'll take it from there. I'm going to dominate this writer's room one way or the other, though.
And Sal's like, there.
What nerds? What kind of nerds have they populated this writing staff with? I'm going to be the funniest guy by a mile when I walk in there. It turns out it's Sal, who is cousin Sal Iacono from Jimmy Kimmel Live, of course.
The meanest guy alive.
And also the loveliest.
Yes.
Not unlike his cousin.
Yes.
They are the most evil, nice guys that you could ever meet, as I always describe them. Then it's Josh Gardner, who may be the single funniest human being that you could ever encounter. He's gone on to do many things for Comedy Central. Kevin Hench, another blue chip comedy guy. And then there's me, and I'm thinking, this is a sports cable trivia show? This is how funny it is to get on this? Oh, I may as well just pack my bags and move on.
You had all your Omar Marino jokes from the 70s Pirates teams. You're like, I got to throw those out.
Yeah, I got through the first my solid gold 3 minutes that revolved around the battling Buccos of 79. Then I was tapped out. But then, like you say, about 10 years later, Sal invites me round about the time we're working on this trivia show. Come over to my place. You know, I live in the basement with somebody. You come by, we'll watch football on Sunday. I have the package. That was a rare treat back then, about 20 years ago. So I did, and so did Kevin Hench. And about 20 minutes after we get there, Jimmy Kimmel walks into the room. I'm like, what's Jimmy Kimmel doing here? And, that's my cousin. This is his house. I'm living in. Then, 10 minutes after that, Adam Carolla walks into the room and does not.
This is like when the Beatles met in Liverpool. This is the comedic Beatles
performing for
the first time.
No, Hench and I guess, are sort of the George and Ringo because John and Paul had already met. But yes,
right.
Those two guys, Kimmel and Carolla, walk in. Kimmel couldn't be more gracious. What can I get for you guys? He's delightful and is the ultimate host, as you understand, Nick. And I'm sorry, we're going to get to you.
I've eaten many a meal at Mr. Kimmel's house. But here's the funny thing about Jimmy Kimmel. Jimmy, I am convinced that I'm the guy who ruined Football Sunday at Kimmel's house. Because
it doesn't happen anymore.
I was working on a project with Carolla. We were writing a movie about the Washington Generals. And that's how I met Adam. I didn't know him. We were just working on this project together. And he would be like, come over on Sunday. We'll write in the morning. And then we'll walk over to Jim. And we walked. It's Jimmy Kimmel's house. I don't know Jimmy. I walk in. The first moment I had with Sal was he just walks over to me and hands me a plate with this incredible cheesesteak. He knew I was a friend of Adam's. And he was – see, here's the thing about Sal. When he doesn't know you, very, very nice to you. Mm-hmm. As soon as he got to know me, like 3 weeks later, he's like, you're too fat. You can't have any more sandwiches. And it's been nothing but fat jokes since then. But I was like the stray cat that you feed that then is on your back porch constantly. And never, because I've never had food like that before in my life. So I just, even on days when Adam and I weren't working, I was just showing up at Kimmel's on my own to go. And one day I showed up and Carolla was like, are we supposed to be working today? I was like, no, I just came for the wings. But I was always smart enough to either bring beer or bring breakfast burritos for the 10 a.m. games, because that's the best thing about moving to L.A. from the East Coast. You start watching football at 10 in the morning. There's no waiting. And I remember one morning showing up there, and the door to Kimmel's house was just open. So I opened it up. I went in. No one's there. So I sat on the couch, started eating a breakfast burrito. At around 9:58, Kimmel's feet start padding down the steps, and he looks. He barely knows me. He's like, hey, morning, Nick. And I've got like a mouthful of beer. I'm like, oh, what's up, Jimmy?
Carolla's husky friend. What are you doing here?
Hey, fatty. What are you doing on the couch? And I'm like, I don't know where Sal is. Door was open. And I think that may have turned things when Kimmel's like, this is getting a little out of hand. And about a year later, he's like, no more football at my house. So I may have been the guy who ruined
it for
everybody.
It's an interesting hypothesis. We really should try to get to the bottom of what exactly happened.
Jimmy doesn't really know me. He just knows me as the guy who showed up at his house, and he's nice enough that when he has a Super Bowl party once a year, which he doesn't really do, haven't even done that the past couple of years, he would throw me an invite. But I was just showing up at his house while he was still sleeping and eating burritos on his couch.
You're right. You'd mention what it turned into, and it really did at the height, right around when you start showing up.
There were 35 people there.
But the thing that was the best about it was, by this point, it had become a noteworthy enough event that random celebrities would show up.
Tom Cruise showed up.
You were there when Cruise showed up.
I was there when Cruise showed up with Sprinkles Cupcakes.
But the best thing, better than any celebrity that walked in the door, was that Kimmel also has for a while now straddled, not just forget about show business, he's really more interested in cooking. And chefs, that's his passion and always has been cooking. He had this brick oven pizza. He had it back there.
It's the best food I've ever had.
15 years ago.
House.
But at some point, he wasn't even making the food. And it was delicious when he was whipping it up. But then celebrity chefs started showing up just to cook for us. And we would have these feasts.
And I would feel like I am a schmuck from New York. I'm a construction worker's son. Now, I saw you yesterday. I'm wearing the same exact clothes I wore yesterday, if you know. Exact clothes.
I didn't have time to notice it because I was too busy putting on the same clothes from yesterday on today.
I am as far out of Hollywood as you can possibly be. I don't go to Hollywood parties. I don't know anyone in the business other than the people I work with. I go home. It's not my thing.
Which says, by the way, if I can say for real, that indicates very subtly, that's not a humble brag. You don't mean it that way. But you are a Hollywood power player in spite of refusing to play the game.
I'm not, but here's the thing. I'm in all seriousness.
Oh, stop.
I'm not, dude. The power.
You have several network TV shows resume.
But I've got one on the air right now.
Well, that makes you a power player.
Look, the truth is, and I'm being dead, and this is not false modesty, but there are the J.J. Abrams and the David Kellys and the superstar guys out there. I'm not one of those guys. I'm a guy. I'll make a nice show, I'll keep it on the air for multiple years. I'll do a good job. There will be no drama. But I'm not into that stuff. So when I'd be at an event and it's like, oh, look, I'd be watching football. And it's like, there's John Krasinski and Tom Cruise. And I'm just like, I just want wings. I just want the wings. And I'd actually leave because I felt so uncomfortable. And I'd go out on like the back patio and like there'd be like the outside TV. And I'd be out there like freezing my ass off eating wings by myself. Because I'm like, I shouldn't be standing near Tom.
Well, okay.
Who am I to stand near Tom Cruise?
Tom Cruise is the best. But about 2 years before Tom Cruise walks in, I spent
Because I was excited when Tom Arnold was there. Do you remember when he showed up? I was excited. I was like, Tom Arnold.
Yeah, he was a nice down-to-earth.
Yeah, he really is. He was a very polite guy.
We would – so about 2 years before Tom Cruise makes his appearance, and that's the biggest star, I think, that ever shadowed the door on football Sunday. But about 2 years before, I spent an entire football season talking to a guy because at some point, to go back, it originally was the very first couple of years and the first
I wasn't there
time
the first
I went there.
Years.
It was me, Hench, and Sal who connected watching football, talking about sports, and then that turned into watching football together over at Sal/Jimmy's house, and then Jimmy, obviously it was his place, so then one thing led to another. Carolla walks into the room on that day, and now there are, you know, it's Jimmy, Sal, it's Hench, it's me. That's it for the room. Carolla walks into the room and goes, there they are. Hey, Sal, fist bump Sal. Hey, Jimmy, fist bumps Hench, makes eye contact with me, moves his eyes over, makes eye contact with Hench, sits down on the couch and does not say a word to either one of us for the next 7 hours. Carolla, what's that about? Why? What are you doing? You're welcome. That was a test. I don't have time to indulge everybody. But the good news is, look, you made it. You made it. I kept you around. So congratulations. Most people don't make the cut.
Little did he know the effect you would have on his life. The great Dave Damischek coming into his life.
Got him fired more quickly than he otherwise might have been.
And secondly, he said a similar thing to me. It was two or three weeks into us working on that Globetrotters movie, and he had said, I'm going to go over to Jimmy's. And I was like, I feel really uncomfortable going over there, Adam. I don't know these people. And this is when there were 30 people. It was like a frat party for a while. And now it's back down to 5 people again. It's me and Adam. And this past football season, I missed most weeks.
At his warehouse with Sal still.
Part of it is I was so busy this past season, I wasn't able to go that often. The other thing is I can only be called fat by Sal so many times. And it's really starting to get to me. But I said to him, like, I feel uncomfortable. And he went, I kissed Jan. You're fine. You're with me. And it was the same thing. And I was like, all right, I guess I'll show up.
Well, it did. It went from it being a small group and then a couple people started showing up over the ensuing couple of years. And then at some point, I don't remember exactly how it turned over to then. It was like, oh, they're secondary players here. Now there are tertiary guys. I don't know who some of these people are that
I
show
was one
up
of
anymore.
Them.
The one time, one season, I talked to this guy in a dirty, scraggly-looking St. Louis Blues ball cap for an entire season. And Sal said to me week 3, week 5, somewhere around there, hey, do you watch Mad Men at all? I've never even heard you mention it, and yet you're talking to him every weekend. And I said, no, I've heard about Mad Men. He said, that guy is the star of the show.
It's Tom Draper.
And he is the object of every woman in America's fancy right now. And you talk to him like it's no big deal. And I said, well, because we're talking about hockey. And we're talking about Bernie Federko. We're not talking
You know, I worked at Bernie Federko's bar in St. Louis.
Oh.
I was a bartender in the St. Louis hockey version of Cheers. It was in St. Louis, and it was all hockey. It was called Federko's, and he would sit there and regale me with – he wouldn't know me. He hit me with his car today. I was 22 years old, saving money for law school, wiping down just a dirty old dish rag, and he would regale me with stories of fights in the NHL in the 70s, and it was great.
Oh,
it
I can't imagine. As a side note, best hockey mask in history. I just went simple – and I said Mike Liut,
and I'm going to go also, because Mike Liut played for the Blues, I'm going to also go, do you remember when Carey played for the Blues, and because of Jim Carrey and the mask, and he had the mask as his mask.
No way, I have
he
no
had the
recollection
green
of that.
Face on the side of his, and that was pretty cool too.
Oh, that's cool. Well, if it looked like the actual mask.
Well, it could only look so much like it because you have the cage in front.
Then the next level, what if you do it and it looks like Jim Carrey's the mask, and then the next guy does one that looks like Rocky Dennis mask.
See, that's not funny, man.
That's too far.
You went too far.
All right, let's just move on. So I talked to John Hamm for an entire season, not knowing who he is.
A guy in the dirty old ball.
And a delightful, you know, that's really how you passed muster, was to not be a pain in the ass the whole time.
Can I jump in with something, though, an observation? You, as a sports guy, you've probably made this observation. This might not be the most unique thing. but a ball cap, a baseball cap with a hockey team on it, always throws me. Or a baseball cap with a football team on it. If you're a baseball fan, wear your baseball cap, put your Yankees, put your Texas Rangers, your Pirates, whatever you want on it.
A little rigid here, aren't we?
But if you're a hockey fan, walk around and wear a hockey helmet. Walk down the street with the hockey helmet. If you're a football fan, full face mask. If you want to go single bird cage, fine. You know, but I don't think you should have a New York Giants baseball cap.
Okay.
You're a Giant fan, wear the helmet, walk down the street.
Remember they used to have ball caps when we were growing up, NFL ball caps that looked like the helmet. Do you remember those?
No.
You don't remember that they were soft and mushy kind of a little
Sounds
bit?
Like a terrible idea.
It was. It did not. Well, actually, in my head, I think that's a pretty good idea. Somebody should bring that back, and then I remember what they looked like, and they weren't good.
But I interrupted you. You said then 2 years
later.
Well,
so then I'm talking to John Hamm. Now I know who he is, and I've properly swooned as a Mad Men Don Draper fan. But now I'm talking to him, and it's old hat, pun intended,
I guess.
It
should be old helmet, but it's old hat.
Right. I'm talking to him, and he looks scraggly like the rest of us do. It's Sunday. It's whatever. You know,
he looks scraggly in a different way the rest of us do. Let's be honest.
Listen, handsome devil.
Dreamboat.
Don't get me wrong. You don't have to tell me twice. Yeah. But over his shoulder, I mean, on a completely different level. Yes, John Hamm, maybe people could have named him sexiest man alive. But then a vision
Nick
over
Santoro
his shoulder.
Nick Santoro walks in.
What? Oh, yeah. Yeah, and then after that, I mean, like a light, a halo around him. A guy shows up with this chiseled jaw. Sure, he's 5'8" or whatever he is. But he's got on a black turtleneck. And over the black turtleneck, a black pea coat. And he walks into the room and John Hamm could have been Nick Santoro for all I
How
cared.
How dare you?
I swooned for Tom Cruise. What a man. And then he came up, and then he does that thing where you realize the way – you know, he has a lot of weird things attached to him from outsiders. I count myself now as a dear friend, so I can talk about what he's
really
like.
From the 30 seconds you talk?
No, but he did that thing where – I can see why a lot of personality traits have been assigned him, but really, he's just super intense, nice guy. He's like, hi, I'm like, hey, I'm Dave. Nice to meet you. He's like, hi, Dave. I'm Tom. Nice to meet you. Like, locks eyes with you and shakes your hand real
eyes,
hard.
His eyes pierce you. I didn't talk to him the whole time because, like I said, I don't have the most self-esteem. Despite the fact that I thought you were talking about me when you said the really good-looking guy who walked in, I wasn't good enough to talk to Tom Cruise, so I went outside in the cold and ate my wings. But when I left and it was time to go, I'm not even exaggerating. I was like, I don't want to be here. I'm very uncomfortable. I went back inside and I always say goodbye to Jimmy. I was like, hey, Jimmy, at this point, it was the 15th time I had watched football there, and I still wasn't sure if Jimmy knew exactly who I was. So I went up to him just to say, he's the host. Thank him for opening his home to you. So I went up and I said, you know, Jimmy, goodbye. Take it easy. Have a happy holidays because it was the break, you know, the winter break. And for people that don't know, in television, the entire business shuts down for about 10 days during winter break. And I turned to leave. Now, Tom Cruise and I had not looked at each other the entire time. I saw him from afar, kind of averted my gaze, like looking at an eclipse, and went outside in the cold to eat my wings. And then when I turned, he popped up off the couch, took a step towards me because I was someone who was leaving. And it is polite to say goodbye. And he stuck his hand out, shook my hand. I mean, it could be in the handbook. It could be in the handshake handbook. How to shake hands. Firm, fast, to the point. Locked eyes with me, lasered through, burned into the synapses of my brain. Just bam, Tom Cruise, right? Hey, take it. Perfect smile. White teeth like little tombstones, all identical. Take it easy. Have a great holiday. Be well. I'm like, okay. I was like, okay, you too. He's like, okay. Now, there is nothing for me to say about the man except he was incredibly polite.
I was going to say, you admire this.
I admire
someone.
Because
you're a man. Right. You're a man of etiquette, of manners.
I like to be polite. I say please and thank you to everybody. It was the way I was raised. I'm not without flaws, and sometimes I'm sure I can be rude and obnoxious like anybody.
No, you definitely can.
Absolutely, I can. But that being said, he was so incredibly polite that's what I remember. And he's smart, because even if he thought the entire time, look out the back kitchen window, look at that fat guy eating wings by himself. What a weirdo. But what he did was he put me in a position where the only thing I can do
that
when
was
I talk
about Sal 20 minutes before Cruz arrived.
Yeah, exactly. But the only thing I can say about him is he's put me in the position of the only thing I can say about him is he's very polite. What a wonderful way to live your life, where when you leave a room, people just go, he's incredibly polite.
The two things I remember about that day, I'm surprised Cruz stuck around that long to bid you farewell, because we walk in the door. First of all, he brought his mom with him, which was funny. And then also, he's like, oh, yeah, I like to watch football, hang out with the fellas. And Kimmel's was like, this was the ultimate, you know, guy, oh, regular guys hanging out watching football kind of vibe. And Cruz showed up, as any diehard football fan would, out here on the West Coast. The second game of the day starts at 1 p.m., ends around 4-ish, you know, 4:15-ish. He showed up at 3:45 to watch football. So we knew, like, a regular guy, just like the rest of us. And but immediately, sauced up Corolla takes the opportunity for what reason, I have no idea.
Oh, dear God.
To impress Tom Cruise and Tom Cruise's mom, he did his famous football celebration, which Doug Baldwin replicated in Super Bowl 49.
Dirty turd.
If you remember.
That's what he calls it, the dirty turd. He pretend to poop out a football.
Now, by the way, to go back, Santora acts like he's a sweetheart. But, of course, where he really won Kimmel and Sal and everybody over was when, on the heels of a Sunday football day, he reported back to Sal, and he knows exactly how it works. Oh, so if you tell Sal –
are we going to waste time on this?
I'm not going to tell the whole story, but you know what you did. Sal is the recorder of everything. So if you want
this is a clean show, right? We don't curse on this show?
Well, that's why I can't go into
it. That's what I'm going to say. But he's a poop stirrer. Can we say that, Sal?
We could say that.
He stirs the poop.
Well, but then the entire – I'm not going to get into a whole story, but I had
– a bit.
And I still have a very funny jag about how, just like our fathers used to tell us, hey, back in my day, we didn't have TV to watch. We only had the radio to listen to and books to read. You guys don't know how good you have it. I have said this is a conversation that we will have to have with our sons about the state of pornography and how different and how much better it is in the 21st century than it was when we were growing up. It's a 20-minute jag, and it's a laugh riot. Well, I show up at the Kimmel show the next day, and Sal's waiting with a cell phone in hand to play back Nick Santora's voice message. Where
it wasn't a voice message. He called me and put me on speaker
to humiliate me in the writer's room.
Because what Damashek's leaving out is the Sunday before at football, I had
this.
Done
my
a,
jag has existed for a quarter century.
I had talked about how I used
years
to watch.
I've been doing this jag.
The football show on HBO, First and 10. And it had mild nudity in it, and I was in sixth grade, and I'd say I'd watch the whole episode waiting to catch a half a mammary flash. I can say that on the show, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Half a mammary flash, and I went through this whole bit, and then
– I watched the Super Bowl in Houston for the same effect, but anyway, go ahead.
And then a buddy of mine was listening to Corolla's old radio show a couple of days later, and Damashek was talking about a very similar thing – except for the show Life Goes – was it Life Goes On?
Yes, no. Mine is Life Goes On, and mine also
with
then
Brian
builds
Ben-Pen.
On that and goes into the other HBO show, Real Sex, and that's where the bit really starts to cook when I start talking. It's a funny bit, but what do I know? I get ambushed. I walk into the Kimmel writer's room, and Sal has Nick Santora on Vel, he calls me. He calls me Vel. That's my Hebrew name is Velville, so Sal calls me that. Vel, come over here. Wait, we got before you leave, but the meeting's not done yet. Nick Santora is on the phone to report
and
back
I killed Kimmel
and a dozen other people in there to humiliate me that I stole Nick Santora's
and what's great
bit.
Is you and I weren't really – and listen, I say we weren't really friends then. We didn't really know each other well. I don't even know if we're friends now. What we are is we're warm associates.
Okay.
I see you once or twice a year, and it's right. Always very nice.
Right.
But if you called me up and said, hey, you want to hang out today, I would find it weird, and I'd come up with an excuse not to do it. And, you know, that's, you know, and the same thing. If I called you up and said, hey, let's spend the day together, you'd go, no.
Wait, Nick Santora, this
yeah.
is. Right.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
is, you're, want to hang, well, who else is coming?
Just me. We go to the lake.
You got a bet? Get?
No. No. If football isn't on a screen somewhere near us, we're probably not seeing each other, which is fine. But we didn't know each other well then. And I got the feeling you sent me an email and you were like, it was like something like, listen, Buster, I don't know you that well. I think you're kidding, but if you're not kidding, could you fill me in so I shouldn't? And I was like, no, dude, I'm totally kidding. I could care less. But I think for a second you thought.
No, I telephoned you and said, what gives? I didn't steal your bit. What I won't have is you thinking. I wasn't upset. I was worried that you thought I stole your bit.
It was all a joke. You may have stolen my bit.
I didn't steal any bits. Now, let's talk about we want to talk a little bit of pro football. Let's talk to Nick for about 15, 20 minutes. This is an ongoing issue for me, Santor, is that we've already gone, what, about 20?
Yeah, about 20 minutes, I'd say.
Okay.
Is that it? It feels like an hour.
Emma VP, do you feel like we've done too much already? Or
no, I'm just getting started.
Can we talk about your acting?
I think
we're not
going to talk about Scorpion.
I want to talk about football. What are you telling me to speed up for, Spaghetti? You want to talk some football?
No, I was going to keep going, please.
Ed Spaghetti, I want you to meet Nick Santor. You guys have one
Ed?
Thing in common. It's your love of the New York Football Giants.
Correct.
I do love myself.
Now you part ways when the puck gets dropped, though, because he likes the blue shirts, Eddie Spaghetti.
Oh,
does,
you're the Rangers.
You like the Islanders.
I like the greatest hockey dynasty in the history of the game.
Lucky that it survived. Michelle Dion had other plans in mind.
Yeah, until we beat you in overtime, thanks to the great John Tinelli and Mike McEwen.
Look who remembers John Tinelli, yeah.
John Tinelli is one of the most underrated hockey players in the history of the game.
That's one of my saddest things. 1982, game 5 of a best-of-5 series.
Down 3-1, the Islanders.
The two-time champion Islanders in Nassau County host the upstart Pittsburgh Penguins.
Game 5.
A decisive game. Lo and behold, the Penguins get up, and they get up 3-1 and 5 minutes left in the game.
I think 3 minutes and 23 seconds left in the game. You're up 3-1, but I could be off a little bit.
Do you know what I did this weekend in anticipation of this conversation? No, I just stumbled into it just randomly because this is what I do as a nerd. I look up random old sporting events, and I found the end of game 5. You can find that on
YouTube.
It's
so great. It's John Tinelli. He scored the two goals.
Game-tying goal
and the game-winning series winner. It was great. And that was a very good Penguins team. They just couldn't beat the greatest hockey dynasty of all time.
I mean, the Islanders are my second most hated team in all of sports. Only the Flyers. Only the Flyers are worse in all of sports for me.
All of sports. The Islanders more than the Patriots.
Well, the Patriots are making their way up the ranks. But, yeah, it is still the Islanders because as a child, those injuries, they never fully heal. You see, I still walk with a limp.
I understand where you're coming from because I am not the biggest fan of the Edmonton Oilers. It has faded over time because the Oilers, like the New York Islanders, have gone through such a futile streak that I feel we're kind of in the same boat now. But when the Islanders lost the drive for 5 and Gretzky and Messier, an incredible team, were skating around holding that cup up, I was hysterical. Hysterically crying, like a family member.
Hate the Flyers as a brand because into the 21st century, they continue to embrace, even though the rest of the game is about every other team has acknowledged, like, yes, what we need is speed and skill.
We're the bullies.
Hey, that guy's a thug. Get him on our team. You want to be? This is your MO? That's what you want to be? I don't like that. But individuals, in any sport, whatever era you want to talk about, I hate Billy Smith, their goalie.
Greatest clutch goalie in the history of the game.
I hate Clark Gillies.
One of the best all-around players to ever play. Could fight, could score, could dish off the puck.
You had – I wonder how many of those guys –
They started the playoff beard. They're the team that created the playoff beard.
Is that true?
Yes. You can look it up. They created the playoff beard, and as a hirsute
Kenny Morrow on the blue line.
Scored the overtime
Denny
goal
Potvin.
To beat the Blue Shirts in
Denny
a game
Potvin fight. Was back
Denny
on that.
Potvin, the greatest defenseman
Butch
ever played
Goring
the game.
Butch Goring was disgusting.
The catalyst. He wore the same childhood
Bobby
helmet.
Nystrom was a creep.
The Norse god. I can go on and on.
What a collection of creeps you
what
had.
What a collection of winners. And Mike Bossy, the greatest pure goal scorer in the history of hockey.
I asked Sidney Crosby and Phil Kessel recently for their esteemed opinions on this. 66 or 99?
I think between the two, if Mario Lemieux's health had maintained, he'd be the greatest hockey player. And people would talk about his greatest hockey player.
I like that. I'll take it. I mean,
and
the asterisk notwithstanding. I mean, even greatest, with the asterisk,
greatest,
he's the best player.
Greatest all-around hockey player. I would still say that Mike Bossy was the greatest natural pure sniper. thousands and thousands of professional NHL hockey
have
players.
Have you not watched this millennium? Because if you watch Ovechkin, you'll see one better than
him. No, wrong. Because I will say this. Thousands of players have played the game. One man scored 50 or more goals 9 straight seasons, and he goes by the name of Michael Tiberius Bossy. And I don't think his middle name is not Tiberius. But when you want to make a point, throw Tiberius into the middle name of somebody, and people just think you've made your
That's
point.
That's a great move. I love
Michael
that.
Tiberius
it
Bossy.
Wasn't like, is that really
no.
Bossy?
No. I saw the look on your face.
That should come up more often if that's really his middle name.
He was incredible. Give that up.
Isn't it weird? I always feel, is it weird to meet, for either one of you, Spaghetti or Santora, to meet somebody who is a Devils fan? Isn't that the weird team to embrace if you're from the tri-state? Unless you're from Jersey, I guess.
It is strange, but if you're from Jersey, I married a beautiful, wonderful Jersey girl, and she has family members that are Devils fans. But they live their whole lives in Jersey. So if you lived your whole life in Jersey, you got to hold on to something.
I remember Chico Resch, early days. That was
Colorado
the only
Rockies,
decent player
Islanders,
they had,
and the Devils.
Something that we were talking about, we have talked about, NFC East to me, and I, obviously.
Just a hard shift to football. You didn't even try to grease the.
That's the way I do it.
That's
See?
Great.
I'm a pro's
I love it.
Pro,
You're very good at this.
I'm transitioning now into, as much as I care about the AFC North and before that the Central, the NFC East strikes me as the most engaging division, and maybe it's owed to the fact that New York City and Philadelphia and these tentpole cities in our society are where these teams are located. But it seems like the rivalries are better.
It's the best rivalries.
In the NFC East,
yes.
Who is you as a Giants fan? Who do you consider your biggest rival?
The Eagles. And so this year was particularly tough. But because I have family that lives in Philly, so there's a lot of breaking each other's shoes back and forth. So I was very happy for them because they've been waiting for it a long time. But at the same time, it sickened me just a little bit. But after a season like the Giants just had, I honestly just didn't care what happened. It's like the house is burning down and the neighbors are putting up beautiful spotlights to show the new porch they put on. Fine. I need to get my house from burn.
We're not even. Yeah, we're not in the competition.
I'm not
this year,
in right? it. I'm not thinking about it. There was no rivalry this year. They just got killed from beginning to end.
It's surprising because a lot of people who root for any of the non-Dallas Cowboys fan who roots for any of the other three teams in the division, more often than not, it's the Cowboys that are the biggest rival. But I've noticed when we talk to Eagles fans, they say the Giants more, and it's because of proximity.
It's proximity. It's a very short drive. It's right there. And the guys your age, my age, were about the same age. A lot of guys from New York – who were Cowboys fans, because when we were kids in the 70s, the Cowboys were good.
You had to
like Cousin Sal, and I can't have less respect for those guys because you were 7, 8 years old, you went against the family. The family was Giant fans. You weren't growing up in New York.
I hear you.
And you went, and not only that, it's not like, okay, I'm going to go against the family and I'm going to like the Vikings because I love the helmets because they're super cool helmets from the 70s. No, because this is the team that's doing the best. You were a front-running 8-year-old. Go to Hades.
Shameful. Listen, you and I park our cars in the same garage. Now, in the 70s, if you are a child of the 80s and you remember Lakers-Celtics and you remember that caused some division, it wasn't really as ground-shaking. Pro football back then and still is more popular than the NBA. In the 70s, you chose one or the other. You rooted. The Cowboys and Steelers were above all others. And if you were with a middling team like the Giants, you vibed to one or the other. But I am with you completely, Santor. It's shameful to embrace the Dallas Cowboys for what it says about you. Even if in the binary choice, you could go with the soul of America who forged our steel to help beat the Nazi scourge and build our ships and our tanks in the big battle.
The Colts? The Colts, Indianapolis?
Listen, don't be wise. Or, they're named after steel. Or you could go with the fancy pants, with the shiny silver and the star on the hat and all the trickery and everything else. What's it say about you philosophically if you chose the latter of those two? But, of course, that was a choice everybody had to make. But at some point, as you grow towards adulthood, it's more important to be a contrarian to your old man Are you putting your foot down with your girls? Are they allowed to root for anyone they want, or do you say they must root for a New York team or two?
My girls are such good girls. They love what daddy loves.
Is that right?
Yeah,
I love it.
They watch football with me. They'll watch the Islanders with me. You know, they're into it. They're into daddy. I'm sure they'll think I'm a putt soon enough, but right now they're into daddy.
I love it. Yeah. I'm worried sick. Right now the kids are embracing Penguins hot, and I do the right thing. Penguins show up in town while we're going to the game. That's going to help indoctrinate them in the right direction.
Get them the T-shirts.
I get them a T-shirt. Oh, you're in Indianapolis doing stuff around the Colts. Here, take some T-shirts home. You have some kids? Can we give them the – No, thank you. I don't want your Colts T-shirts because they'll put it on at this impressionable age and they'll never let go. The only stuff that they wear is black and gold stuff in my home. But anyway, so we're talking Giants. What do you think about – and then we'll talk some Scorpion here. What do you think about what the Giants are going to do in the draft coming up?
I think they have a lot of options. I think there are a lot of really good players in this draft that they need. You've got guys like Chubb. You've got great offensive linemen in Notre Dame. You've got a couple of choices coming out of Notre Dame. And you've got three or four potential maybe franchise quarterbacks. And it's so hard with quarterbacks to tell. I'm not one of these guys. I hate – the day after the draft, you're talking to friends, and they're like, oh, my God, why'd they take this guy? Why'd they take, I'm trying to think of an old Giant draft, and they took, like, William Roberts in the first round. Like, why'd they take him? Well, because he wound up being a starting offensive lineman for 5 years or 6 years and really helped. Nobody watching every Division I game, and you know every offensive
Everybody
lineman.
Everybody is. I mean,
no one knows anything.
It is the most pretentious
it's such
thing
BS.
In all of pro football fandom. And even people who are in the game can't really break down certain positions for you. I love all these people. Got to be Quentin Nelson. I mean, the guy's a road grader, man. Got to get him in. What do you know about Quentin Nelson except what you've heard people
say? The same things about Tony Mandarich. No one knows.
You have no idea.
No one knows.
But I do know this, that it's really a coin flip when you start talking about quarterbacks. And if Eli Manning, if the premise is, hey, Eli's our starter in 2018, a lot of people, and these things happen often in pro football if you look at the trajectory of these things in the age of free agency. All right. Collectively, people were wrong about the Giants going into 2017, that they weren't going to, this is a team that might make a Super Bowl run. They certainly are going to be in contention for the East. I think we did, to our credit, MVP. We sniffed out before the season kicked off that the Giants were not going to be good, and I picked the Eagles, actually, to pat myself on the
back.
Look
at you.
That's right. But if the thought is we're bringing Eli back for that dollar figure and for the fallout of benching Eli last year, if you're doing that, why would you possibly take a chance on a QB instead of building the best possible 2018 team you can for Eli?
Well,
right?
I think if you're looking at it, you're like, okay, let's see if we can get two more years out of Eli. He's 37 and a half. How many quarterbacks are good at 40? You got Tom Brady and very few others. So we get a guy, we have him learn under Eli's tutelage for 24 months.
People always say that as if there isn't evidence that no one ever does that outside of Aaron Rodgers under Brett Favre.
Eli Manning did it for a season under Kurt Warner, and supposedly Kurt Warner was really cool about it and taught him and was a good guy. But those are the rumors. Who the heck knows? But my feeling is with look, I was a Giant fan I've been a Giant fan my whole life, and I went through the Dave Brown, Danny Cannell, Kent Graham years. Where those guys rotated.
I have tabbed that, by the way. I have announced that as the worst QB trio on one team in the history of pro football.
And it might not be inaccurate. And by the way, they could be lovely guys. They could be wonderful guys. Look, you make it to the NFL, you're an incredible athlete. They all probably tried really hard. It didn't work. They brought in Mike Tomczak for a little while there. I mean, it was rough. I know what it's like to have no quarterback. And people forget. People forget in everything. People forget in everything. In politics, in life, they forget. If things get too easy, they forget why things are so good. And people forget what it was like before Eli came around. You need a quarterback. I don't know who that quarterback is. I don't know enough. And, people are saying, take the running back out of Penn State. Fine, but I've seen a lot of teams get led to the playoffs into Super Bowls with fourth-round running backs. I don't know what the answer is. All I know is last year was really painful. I'd love a few more wins this year. I don't know what's going to happen.
Well, we could go on and on about that. But as far as being a Giants fan watching the Eagles win, Spaghetti over here, and he's not the only one to say this, did you share the sentiment that you wanted the Patriots to win because then it makes the Eli's Giants look all the more impressive for being the only team that could vanquish Brady, the only antidote to the dynasty?
No, because I think that the teams that the Giants beat were so much better than this Patriots team, especially the undefeated team. That goes down as the greatest Super Bowl victory ever. That was incredible. We stopped a team from running the table. But I did want the Patriots to win for a couple of reasons. One, I'm one of the few, I'm one of the rare Giant fans who does not hate Brady and Belichick. First of all, why would I hate him? We beat him both times in the Super Bowl.
Well, you should like Belichick. There should be a
and
soft spot
Belichick
for Giants
and
fans.
Belichick did a very good job. He did an excellent job when he was the Giants. Also, when the guy seems to work harder than anyone else in the game and constantly do better than everyone else in the game, I appreciate that. Tom Brady hasn't had a piece of crust off a piece of toast in 15 years. The guy refuses to smell a donut that, it, God forbid, it, you know, puts on an ounce. Anyone who works that hard, let him win a football game. I can't.
All right, he's won one. He won many. It's enough already.
I can't walk past a bakery without going in and getting two bear claws and a cruller.
I like Ben Roethlisberger, though, for the exact opposite reason? Like, that guy clearly is eating the burger and the fries and still winning games on Sunday.
You can
That's
like
a
him
lot
for
like
that.
Dave.
You can like him for that reason, too. But I just figure if you're working that hard, win the game. I also wanted to break my cousin's shoes in Philly if they lost. But I'll be honest, and I know this isn't what I should be saying on a sports podcast, but I was disengaged. I watched the game. I placed a couple of fun bets. But I was just exhausted from watching the Giants get their lunch fed to them for an entire season.
I hear you. It breaks your will. Yeah, that's the much better choice. I always say much better to be out of it by the end of September. Don't go through the heartache. I mean, I'm still fully engaged and hoping that the Steelers are going to get the seventh Lombardi, and then I have to watch a team in turquoise and bronze helmets. They couldn't even decide on a helmet color, but they know enough to beat the Pittsburgh Steelers. It makes me sick to this day. I think you're in a better place than I am.
Yeah, I was very zen about it this year.
When you mentioned those QB groups, is Eli Manning a Hall of Fame? Well, first of all, a lot of people want to debate whether he's a Hall of Famer. Clearly he is a Hall of Famer. Agree or no?
Yeah, I mean, two Super Bowl MVPs, it's hard to argue not.
Does he have the worst collection of pass catchers in his career of any Hall of Fame quarterback?
I think there's a strong argument to be made. I will say that when Phil Simms had his spectacular Super Bowl, with still to this day the highest passing percentage in the history of a Super Bowl.
He had Mark Bavaro,
who was a very good pass, but he had Stephen Baker, the touchdown maker, poorly named.
Never
scored any touchdowns.
Yeah, right.
Bobby Johnson.
It rhymed, though.
Yeah, Bobby Johnson, who was, you know, would now be the number four or five receiver on almost any team. Phil McConkey, 5'3.5", 109 pounds, out of the Naval Academy. I mean, the guy was tiny. His Super Bowl touchdown was a deflection tip off of Bavaro, barely caught. They did not have incredible wide receivers. I think was Lionel Manuel on that 86
yeah,
team?
Yeah, you're right.
And Lionel, I mean, these are, again, if you're in the NFL.
Joe Morris
you know
was a good little
doing.
Runner like C.J. Anderson, but.
Joe Morris, not
a world beater.
But
either.
Joe Morris had one season where he almost broke Jim Brown's touchdown record, if you remember. He had one Monday night game against the Redskins. He had three touchdowns, and one of the touchdowns, the guy ran out of his shoe. Does anyone remember that? Look it up on YouTube. Ran out of his shoe in the last 20 yards of the touchdown. He's running with one sock flopping. Joe Morris was a very good running back. I mean, he had well over 1,000 yards and, like, he had 28 touchdowns. I mean, the guy
was
incredible.
Very good. What I remember him initially was going to see him play the mighty Pitt Panther football teams in Pittsburgh when they were perennially top 10. And Syracuse was crummy, and they would come in and be like, who is this little guy running all over this mighty Pitt defense?
Those small, stocky, they're just blocks of muscle running backs are often really,
Our
really effective.
Our guy Maurice Jones-Drew, and probably chief among them. All right, we could talk about sports all day. And listen, I think he's earned – what do you think, Spaghetti and MVP? Can we have him on to talk sports?
I was going to say, I'm having a blast.
Absolutely.
I don't even want to chime in because I wanted this to keep flowing. It was going really well.
Look at these. Where do you get these young whippersnappers with all their energy and their dynamism? Is that a word?
What I like most is that what they say behind my back is their business. What they say to my face, though, is all building me up. And that's really what
when
I
they're looking at your face, yeah. They're kissing your tuchus.
That's right.
And that's what you want.
As a vain person, understand that I try to point it out, and people don't seem to quite get this. There's narcissistic, and then there's vain. I am vain.
Right.
You understand?
I do understand.
I'm vain. I need those boosts.
But I will say this about you, and I don't want to say this because I'm afraid what it'll lead to with you. Mm-hmm. But you're a deceptively handsome man.
No, I mean I don't know about
almost aggressively handsome.
Why the adverb? Deceptively.
Deceptively.
I don't get why the deceptive. What's deceptive about it? I think it's pretty straightforward.
When I first look at you for a second,
yeah.
You have a bird-like face. It's a little.
What is that? Matt, bird-like
it's
face.
It's a little hawkish. There's a little bit of sharp, angular. But if you get a better look, and
that's
I think
that's something to laugh about.
And I think the beard covering the bottom third of the face helps, gives you a very, you know, sexy kind of rugged appearance, and it works for you. I think it's wonderful. And unlike me, you've kept your hair, which helps a great deal.
Well, I mean, I still do pepper in the flesh yarmulke in the back there. You know, I have to fill that in.
Do you use the hairspray that
not
fills
the not the
the hair in a can?
Yeah, not the hair in a can. I don't think they even do that anymore. That's what was his name, Ron Popeil. He did that. No, now I use the powdery stuff. It's like powder that comes in a little, looks like a.
Like a woolly willy, those things where you used to use the magnet. And
that's exactly what it's like. That's exactly what it's like. It's like a salt and pepper shaker. You just like three and I have a full head of hair. You'd never know the difference. People say to me, well, you know, you could get hair plugs back there. And they say, don't get hair plugs in the front because that everybody can see that you have
right.
That a mile away. But if you get them in the bald spot, like a flesh yarmulke, as I say, they say that it'll be indistinguishable to the naked eye. But then, of course, then I would have to periodically keep getting it filled in more and more as I bald further and further. And because at some point, if I didn't do that, I would then wind up with a flesh moat around the fake hair island.
You're thinking ahead. You're
and
planning.
I don't want that ahead. I get
You're
it.
Thinking ahead about
Good
your
writing.
Head.
So anyway, yes, I do that. Now let's kibitz about – see, Spaghetti loves – the football, the New York talk. He really is the quintessential New York sports fan. He says ridiculous things like, you know what, for my money, still nothing like Yankee Stadium when it's rocking in October.
Yeah, what's wrong with that incredibly factual, accurate statement?
Thank you.
Is there any number of places that are more electric than Yankee Stadium?
No.
But we don't need 100,000 like a college football
stadium. I didn't say crowd size. I'm just talking to you about environment.
I used to go to Yankee games in the 70s, and the electric thing was wondering if you're going to get to your car alive when the game was over. You used to park in dirt lots like two or three blocks away because we couldn't afford. You know, I'd go with my cousins or whatever, and I was like 9, 10 years old, and like my cousin who was like 19 would take me to a game. And when it was over, like, it's 1978, like, Bronx is burning stuff. And my cousin Philly would be like, okay, Nicky, listen, as soon as we get out, we're going to run our A's off. And we're going to run as fast as we can, and it's two blocks down, and you stay right behind me because I'm not holding. If I lose you, I lose you. And we just run. I'm running like crazy. And we get to the car, and we get out of there. It was dangerous. People were getting shot and killed. They were burning the city down, but it was exciting. I still have my Reggie Jackson Reggie Bar T-shirt from the day from the day the Reggie Bars were handed out. I happened to go that day. First of all, Reggie Bars, delicious.
They don't do enough of that. 21st century athletes have a lot of marketing opportunities that their forefathers didn't. But that in the 70s, that was the heyday of, oh, you're a good athlete? Let's make a candy bar out of you.
I tried a couple of years ago when Derek Jeter was years ago, and he was going for his 3,000th hit, and I partnered with a guy, and we were trying to get the rights, and blah, blah, blah. And this is a guy who was a big-time sports agent at one point. We were trying to do the Deuce Bar, which kind of sounded like a
poo. I was just going to say, they should. My joke was going to be maybe they shouldn't have called it number two, but it sounds like you'd beat it.
We were going to call it the – and then we thought of different names. It was originally the Deuce Bar. And we said maybe it shouldn't be chocolate.
Chocolate log.
Big chocolate log. but we couldn't. But, yes, you should have, you know, oh, my gosh. How about a Damashek bar?
You know what? Keep talking.
How
I'm
about
listening.
A Damashek bar? I would say, like you, deceptively handsome, deceptively delicious. Little bit. Got to have nuts in there.
Yeah.
No dark chocolate.
I love dark chocolate. It's my only way.
No, milk chocolate.
No, I don't go milk. I go dark. I go you know what?
We were having such a nice time.
The cacao, you know how that's the thing now when you buy chocolate bars?
Oh, the percentage?
The percentage?
The higher the percentage it goes, the crappier the taste.
I go crazy high on the percentage.
Emma knows.
I agree.
Some people
you
check
like
out
the sea salt. On
some
top
people
of it.
Check
I like
out.
A little sea salt on my chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to put a pinch of salt in your bar.
Oh,
if you let me
okay.
put if you let
All
me
right.
put a pinch of salt
can
in your bar,
some
we'll
caramel.
Go, the sister of caramel.
Butterscotch.
Nougat.
Ah.
Nougat. I'll give you the dark chocolate if we can put the sea salt on it. And then some nuts in there. And I like bars that aren't bars, but they're like goo goo clusters.
I understand what you're getting at
and
there.
Yes, it looks like a Bigfoot print paw, except it doesn't look like anything except a clump.
I like that. I like because yeah, on the candy aisle, you want it to break through in some way, and most of them are rectangular in shape. This will be eye catching. And by the way,
it looks
we
like
need,
a horse. What is Horseshack ink blot tests or whatever?
Maybe there's a way to make the candy bar look like it has a beard on it. And that'll be our.
That's the gooey nougat hanging on the bottom
yarmulke,
third,
like
and maybe, the top is just yes.
All right, we'll work on that. Now, Eddie Spaghetti was excited to meet you based on your New York sports allegiances. Emma VP is a burgeoning writer herself. In fact,
nice.
About 8-10 months ago, she was named the head writer of the Dave Damashek football program.
Look at that!
It's an honor to be the head writer of a
now,
podcast.
Congratulations! By the way,
we have 3 to 4 written assignments annually. So,
anyone made this call about Emma?
What's that?
Young Emily Blunt.
Wow.
Look at the
that
face.
That is pretty good, yeah.
You never noticed that?
I like it very
looks
much.
Exactly like
he's
her.
He's engaged, Santor. Settle down.
I'm happily married. I'm just making a comment on
I'm a regular guy. I fell through the cracks. Showbiz didn't even know I was here. That's why I'm successful.
That's I sound like
Rodney Dangerfield all of a sudden.
What advice, because people ask me, and that's a foolish endeavor to say, Dave, what tips do you have for a young writer? Like, I don't know, get lucky like I did, because that's the extent of how I made it. Just I happened to.
Who told you that you should be writing for a sitcom years ago while watching football? This guy.
Well,
yeah, if you remember, I did tell you that.
I do, and I appreciate that. But what advice do you, as someone who is an actual successful self-made writer, what advice do you have?
Well, the self-made is the most important part. I can't tell you how many people think it's who you know. And but my dad was a union carpenter and my mom was a bank teller and a secretary. I lived 3,000 miles away. I could not have had less connections to this business. The best way, the only way I knew how to do it, and I tell young writers this all the time, got to write your way out of it. You have to write every single day. And as soon as you're done, I either know writers who 5 years later are still working on that one idea, or they finished it, but 5 years later, they're still shopping that one idea around. As soon as I'm done with a project, I start writing another project.
Are you a guy, though, who are people now, based on your success, coming back around? What else do you got? Do you have anything that you've been sitting on for 10 years that
I'm not Vince Gilligan, no. And I'm not Vince Gilligan, and I say that because that's not a swipe at Vince Gilligan. That's a compliment.
I get it, yeah.
He created Breaking Bad, one of the greatest television shows of all time. And so people instantly said, what else do you have? I'm not that. I know I'm a working writer. And not that he's not working, but what I'm saying is I haven't had that zeitgeisty Breaking Bad type experience. But I do have people coming to me and saying, be it a studio or a producer who owns a piece of property saying, I have this property, will you write it for me? That happens very often. The problem is the majority of ideas are bad. If you're a construction worker and you're trying to build a building, 99% of the idea is going to be bad. The 1% best ideas will wind up being the skyscraper that's built. 99% of the ideas that are pitched to me, 99% of the ideas that I pitch in the writer's room
it
are
It is
bad.
Vaguely, you know, it's not, I wouldn't say dispiriting, but it is just something that you better be able to accept or you're going to have a tough go of it. Even for me, anecdotally, you know, I get staffed on the Kimmel late night show. You better be used to the fact that literally 98% of your pitches are going nowhere.
Yeah.
You have to keep coming up with stuff all the time.
I have the majority of the stuff I've written and worked on has not been made and will never be made. But a couple of years ago, I wrote a miniseries about Ponzi. Everyone knows Ponzi scheme. No one knows anything about Ponzi.
Hmm.
An incredibly interesting guy. And I wrote it on spec. No one asked for it. I was fascinated with it, and I wrote this period piece on Ponzi. It's hard to get – it's easier now. This was like 4 or 5 years ago. Now with streaming, people want those 6-8 episodes, and it might have another life somewhere. But someone who had read it – and it was very well received. It was just like, what do we do with this? Someone who read it recently reached out to me and said, hey, that period piece, that historical drama that you wrote about Ponzi was great. How would you – would you be interested in writing a little six piece on Booth and the hunt for Booth after he assassinated Lincoln?
Wow.
Unfortunately, I'm kind of booked with some other projects I'm doing, and I didn't have the time to devote to it. And something like that needs to be – it's historical. It needs to be really good. But that Ponzi thing probably – it hasn't been made and probably will because probably – nothing ever gets made. 99% of things don't get made. But the fact that I wrote it led to a potential job. If I wasn't so busy, maybe I could have taken it. The first screenplay I ever wrote in my life, the one that got me into the business, the one that won a film festival, has never been made. I wrote it in 2001. Never been made. Got me my first 5 jobs. I eventually turned it into a novel. The novel was a national bestseller, but the screenplay still sits on a shelf. You have to constantly write. And know, while you're writing it, odds are this never gets made and never sells. But it could lead to other work. And if you want to be a professional writer, you just have to constantly, constantly write and know that you're writing it for yourself and your spouse or your boyfriend or your girlfriend, whoever, to read it. And that's probably all that'll ever read it.
I think we need – I really, just because I don't want to hold Santora up and turn this into a 17-hour episode.
You're not – I've got nothing
episode.
To do.
I think a deep dive on all this stuff is because that monologue that you just did, self-serving and as it was
what was self-serving? I was talking about stuff of mine that didn't sell.
Anyway,
listen. It was helpful to me, Dave.
All right.
Yeah, it's about.
No, I'd love to hear
more
about
Miss Blunt.
Do you have a? Well, so I don't want.
How is it? No. Because now
you feel because now, you've told me I don't think I couldn't make it writing on the Kimmel show. I don't think I got. Do you really feel like because you feel I don't have that that color in the rainbow or whatever to be that way? When obviously you're a funny person and a smart person, do you feel like, well, just because you can write one thing, you can't? Do you have a genre that you need?
Well, I'm
to
scared
focus
to say
on?
Anything now. It might be self-serving, jerk. I literally just gave a speech where I said 2 things I wrote. Never, ever sold, never, ever sold. And you said, how self-serving?
I know. Listen, I don't know why I said that.
You're a jerk.
I was trying to make spaghetti laugh.
That being said, and now I'm going to say something.
He's my muse.
Now I'm going to say something that's self-serving.
All right.
You had said earlier, drama, 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 and I've written a lot of dramas. I, Scorpion on CBS, which we'll get to, talk about your incredible acting on it, is an hour-long comedy. It's an action comedy. It has some dramatic stuff in it every once in a while. It is essentially an action comedy. I wrote with another writer, Barry Schwartz, very talented writer. We wrote a half-hour comedy for the heck of it. That's the other thing you have to do. You got to be willing to work for free all the time. Not once in a while.
It's funny because
every year.
You and I mutually know some people who say the exact opposite. No. You don't. You establish that you're willing to do stuff for free, people will always take advantage of that.
Well, I don't work for free for other people. I work for free for me. I will write stuff for me and hope I sell it. When I was breaking into the business, if you want to get into a business, yeah, then you work for free and show people what you can do. And I don't mean work for free and violate guild laws and labor laws. I mean, you know, internships and stuff like that. Yes, so they can see what you're doing and what you're capable of. But I wrote a half-hour comedy about cancer, of all things. It was set in an oncology clinic. I've been my family and loved ones have been touched by cancer, and I've lost people to cancer, and I wanted to be able to take a big whiz on cancer and let people who are going through it say, you know what, I'm going to laugh at this thing, and I'm going to get through it, and give them a little bit of hope. And got a lot of stuff from certain people in my stable of reps who said, well, you know, why are you writing this? You write hour-long stuff, and it's comedy, and it's cancer, and it's completely not marketable, and this is no one's going to buy this, blah, blah, blah. Well, a little gentleman by the name of Paul Feig read it, get a phone call out of the blue. I was laughing hysterically on one page, crying on the next page, laughing my tail off the next page. You guys wrote MASH. I want to direct this. I want to produce it with you. Let's go. That's what happens when you branch out. And then we sold it to, I'll say it now, it's over and done with. We sold it to Vimeo, who said, you know, we're doing, I don't know if you remember, like about a year ago, Vimeo made this big announcement. We're doing original programming. We're putting tens of millions of dollars behind it. I met with them. They go, we're not ordering a pilot. We're ordering a whole season.
Hmm.
And you have complete creative control. Go for it. Go. This is going to be great. I'm working with Paul Feig. I'm working with my buddy Barry. We have complete creative control. We have a whole season. The lawyers are working out the deal. And then I wake up one morning, big announcement. Vimeo cancels all original programming 3 weeks after they basically gave us the green light. It's the first time I have ever had a network canceled on me.
That's crazy. That's a weird story. But the larger point about the falling apart. I mean, I always say the happiest you will ever be is when you get a call that – you know, you've made a submission and you're getting staffed on the first show that you get staffed on. Or I suppose, hey, there's some interest in what you wrote and they're going to advance it to the next stage. You think, well, I'm about to have a hit TV show. And of course, there are 17 steps beyond that.
Everything
one that you have to get over. And at each one, it's perilous. And the percentages do not favor you. Once you get to a certain stage, they're like, well, we're about 75% of the way home. It's always, oh, we're going to pilot? Yeah, you and 12 other shows are like you know, to break through.
Or then you get fired. Your show gets picked up. And then they make it, right?
They do two episodes. It didn't rate, and that's it.
The show gets canceled, or the show's going to get picked up. It's going to keep going. It's never happened to me, but it's not like it can't. You knock heads a lot with people while making shows because you have to fight for your vision, and you know what's right for the show or what have you. And you annoy enough people, and you're fired, and someone else is running the show you created. It's a tough, tough business.
We should really do it. Let's do a whole tutorial with Nick Santora. But do you abide by write what you know?
To start off, at the very least, write what you know, because that's going to be your strongest piece of material.
I mean, I guess you don't know Ponzi, you know.
No, but I wrote it based on this incredible book and I did all the research and stuff. But the first thing you write, stay in your wheelhouse or stay in what you're passionate about, even if it's something like science fiction, which you can't really know what it's like to live on another planet. But if it's your passion, write that and see how it turns out. But the thing is, don't expect anyone, you know, this is the guy. If I can get it to this guy, he's going to help me or this is going to happen. I have people reach out to me all the time. People think showrunners have so much more power than they do. The network and the studio, they sign off on every writer. They sign off on every actor. The showrunners don't – I don't have the power to – I want that writer and that actor. If they don't want it, it's not happening. And very few showrunners wield that power. You have to write something that blows people away or gets people excited, and then they will hire you.
It is in a way, it's I imagine there's some percentage of people who might be interested in this, which is I don't know how many people. I think you know, comedy writing for TV, writing movies sounds like a fun profession to almost anybody. But I think it's so to a large percentage of those people who have that who in their own head believe this is my dream. This is what I want to do for a living. It might hit their ear a little unsatisfying to hear like that there's a magic bullet. It's like getting in shape.
I recently had a screen. It's go back to sports. It's supposed to be about sports. We haven't talked about it in a while. I wrote a screenplay about Clemson football, a true story about Clemson football. 9.5 years ago. And 5-6 months ago, Disney out of the blue is, hey, can you do a rewrite of that script? We want to make it. It's been sitting on a shelf for 9.5 years. You never know. Write the stuff. Bust your tail. A lot of lonely hours sitting by yourself. I got a terrible pinched nerve in my neck that runs down my left arm because I'm always hunched over the keyboard with terrible, what's the word? Ergonomic posture. Is that the word?
I think
ergonomic.
That's right.
Ergonomic. Ergo. I say it in the continental sense. And it is what it is. It's a lot easier than doing what my dad did for a living. I'm not making that comparison. It's a lot easier than what my mom did for a living, to be honest. But it's the only thing I'm good at. I don't have a choice. I'm not good at anything else.
See, he goes self-deprecating right at the end there, but very informative stuff.
Can we talk about your acting?
Yes, let's talk about it. Well, you know what?
Oh, we're never getting
to it. I think this has gone well enough that we'll bring Nick back for another episode, and Emma can have a list, a questionnaire of 10
or
something like that, and just pour, you know, tap into the brain of Nick Santora. She's also got a hot 2.5 men spec that she really would like you to
nice.
Pass around show business.
There we go.
Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, but, you know, same thing.
So spec scripts are still a thing, huh?
I guess I haven't. I mean, my spec script that I wrote was in 2001.
When I got out here, yeah, you had to write. That was the thing. You needed two so-called spec scripts, which are episodes of existing TV shows that you
I wrote
could
a practice.
Write in a voice and all that.
I wrote one for the practice.
I was doing. I wrote Everybody Loves Raymond.
Yeah.
And I don't remember what else. But anyway, all right, yes, let's talk about the here and now. Scorpion, Monday night, 10 p.m. Eastern.
There you go.
CBS, Catherine McPhee. That's the first question about that. Has she asked about me since we shot together?
You know, it's funny. She hasn't stopped talking about you. Mm. She also found you incredibly handsome.
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding. She hasn't mentioned you once.
Well, she and I mean, I know that's she's a pro and I'm a pro.
Can I talk about that scene in all seriousness?
Yeah.
You were great.
All right.
And I'll tell you why you were great. Because Kat came into that scene a ball of fire. She was annoyed at your character because, shocking, you played an obnoxious sports announcer.
I had to spread my wings. I appreciate you giving me that space to show what I have.
I did. I said, you know, I'm going to have to ask him to really stretch a little bit. And you did.
Obnoxious sportscastery type of guy.
Obnoxious. Can you try to imagine being that? And you pulled it off. But Kat came into that scene full of energy, tore you a new one, and you looked at her. You stayed in character. You delivered a comedic line incredibly well. And then you gave the right eyebrow raise, which I'm doing right now. You gave the little Belushi. And you did it so well. But the other thing that you did, and you lied to your audience to start off this podcast. And you said about a month ago I called you. I called you about 10 months ago. But people don't realize this about Dave. And again, Dave and I, we don't hang out. We're not best buds. I don't know where you live.
I have four children.
Well,
I don't know, I have no time to hang out with what?
I don't know the names or genders of your children. I don't know where you live. I don't really know anything about you except Pittsburgh. Other than that, I don't know anything about you.
After this, you and me will go to dinner. We're
66. Yeah, whatever it is. That's what I know about you. And Willie Stargell. That's it. That's all I know. Mm-hmm. But you don't return phone calls. You are impossible to get in touch with. I called you and left a message, and you should have heard me at football, cursing you up and down.
Is this a true story?
This is a true story. I left you a message at the beginning of football season.
Really?
And I left you a message and said, hey, Dave, it's Santora, long time no speak. I probably hadn't spoken to you in like a year. Long time no speak. I'd like to put you on my little show, Scorpion. I knew I wanted to do this episode, which we filmed at the end of the season, before we started the season. I always plan the whole season out as much as I can in my head. But then I sit down with the real stars of the show, which are our writers, and we really flesh it out. But I knew I wanted to do this episode. And I knew you would have been the perfect announcer in this episode. And I said, call me back, would you? Crickets.
I didn't get the message.
Crickets. Yeah, okay. Then
I didn't get the message.
I go into then,
my cell phone.
Show
I guarantee
him the icons on your
has
phone.
100. Yeah, that's true.
He's got like thousands of emails.
No, he doesn't. He's a very important.
Yes.
That's what it is.
Highfalutin.
Look at this.
It's
right there, my
producers to get it.
I have 50,417 unread emails.
Let me tell you, that's a sign of a chaotic mind. Let me show you mine.
I bet you it's nice and clean. Whatever. What can I tell you? I'm not going to suddenly become organized now, so why would I even try?
Yeah, that's chaos. You can't live your life that way. Let's look at mine. Oh, wait a minute. Five.
This is how you wind up with four children spread across the San Fernando
Johnny
Valley.
Davey Appleseed. So I called. So I go to football, and I said, hey, Sal, what's up with your friend Dave? I can't get this. He goes, oh, you can't get Damashek on the phone. We all try. We email him. We call him. We text him.
Listen.
Dan Dratch says he can't get in touch with you. Sal says he can't get in touch with you. Corolla says it's difficult sometimes. And so all I know,
Corolla's voicemail has been full for 15
I know.
Years. He's nobody
I'd say that's a little bit of pot calling the kettle black in that instance. I agree with you. So then I call your agent. Hey, it's Nick Santar. I'd like to talk. And I got his assistant or someone on the phone. I'd like to talk to Dave's agent about being on this wonderful show, Scorpion. Sure, absolutely. I haven't called you back. 1 week, 2 week, 3 weeks. No callback. Your agent won't call me back. I'm going nuts at football every Sunday. I'm like, this SOB. I go, how many network shows is he offered to act on?
I didn't know
that
any.
That he's not calling me back.
I heard that my people contacted me to know that there was some interest.
Yes.
In an appearance on
yes.
Scorpion.
Well, then I called back.
I misunderstood what I was supposed to do.
I got the great Leah Thompson from Back to the Future.
Sure.
Mrs. McFly. I got her to be on the show easier than you. Who are you?
Caroline in the City.
Yes. She was, by the way, she's delightful.
Is she?
But who? Yes, she's wonderful. Who are you to not call back?
I'm a schnook. I feel like I'm nobody wants it.
Oh, I wanted you, baby. I knew you'd be perfect.
Like, it's like, you know what? He's a dope. Yeah, give him, throw him a bone.
Well,
that's how
I finally got your agent. The funny thing, I called up again. I said, hey, what gives? Why no return phone call? Why am I on the pay no mind list? And the assistant goes, yeah, we tried your number, and it didn't work. I must have written it down wrong. And I said, really? Because it's so hard to get in. Call my agent. You can get in touch with me in 5 minutes. Call CBS, whatever it is. And finally got in touch with you, and you said you'd do the episode. Dare I say, you were a little nervous when I talked to you on the phone. Some emails. I felt a little bit of the nerves in the emails.
I told you outright, of course.
Yeah.
You said, don't be nervous. This will be a breeze. I said, my default setting is nervous. I'm nervous.
But you know
24
what
hours a day, even in my sleep, I'm nervous.
But you know what you did because you were nervous? You prepared. I love the expression, over-prepare. You don't want to over-prepare. BS, I want everyone over-prepared. That means you know your lines. You showed up. You knew your lines. It was one of the – you have a few moments in your career. This past year, we opened up the season with a musical number that I wrote. It was a dream sequence. It was a big musical. We got to record it at the Capitol Records building, Studio A, where Sinatra recorded Come Fly With Me, 28-piece orchestra. And I'm sitting there amongst the musicians, the composer, the great Tony Morales, said, come in here and sit here and just be in the room. And I sat there, and I just closed my eyes and listened to these incredible musicians play music for this silly ditty I wrote for my fun little show. And I thought to myself, I used to be a lawyer. I would be in Brooklyn schlepping depositions right now if I hadn't started writing. How lucky am I? And it was this great life moment. And I really felt great.
Important to try to take those little moments. I periodically will do that myself. Yeah.
Yes, and because you don't take life for granted. The night we were filming with you, the sun had just gone down. We were filming on a baseball diamond. There were people there who brought their kids. They were playing catch in the outfield. My wife and kids were there. We were having snacks. You were up in the booth, in the announcer's booth, and I was down on the ground, so I was calling notes up to you like Romeo and Juliet. It was quite romantic. The moon was out. It was so – and the stuff you were saying was so fun because you were putting your spin on it, your take on it, and I thought to myself at that moment, what a blessed life I have. I really did at that moment because I was having – my family was there. Everyone was having fun, and you were part of that great moment in my life. So thank you for doing it.
Oh, stop.
Because it was wonderful.
It was listen, it was a hoot for me, but having had no experience
you
in
killed
doing
it. You
that,
crushed it.
I felt like the whole time – I asked the guys that were up in that booth with me, all the crew guys, the sound guy and the camera guy and everything else. I kept apologizing.
I know,
to
you
them.
Were mic'd. I heard you.
Oh, I felt like I didn't know what the standard was. I said, I'm sorry I flubbed that line. I didn't know, like, should this be taking about hour less than what I'm taking to get this
fast,
thing?
It went faster than it should have gone because you were so prepared. And we have actors show up on any show at any time. Actors will show up. And for whatever reason, and I don't think it's because they don't care, they'll hit a mental block. There'll be a patch of dialogue that trips them up, and it gets crazy where the actor will then get into his or her own head and not be just literally not be able to do it.
Why are people so, – it is a weird thing. I marveled, and MVP can confirm that this is true. In the days leading up to it, I said to her, is it expected that I know all my lines when I show up there? Because I guess it is, and I didn't realize until the week before when you sent the script. I thought, Santora gave me a line,
you had 20 lines.
To what end? I thought it was going to be something like that.
Shame the devil.
I thought it was going to be something like that and then go home. But then I'm going through, I'm like, these are monologues I have. And I got to do a scene with Catherine McPhee?
Do a scene with Catherine McPhee.
I got nervous and I figured I better know these lines. And it was not easy to learn. How do actors, it's what I always say. People say, look at those NFL playbooks. Those must be impossible to learn. And my pushback is, if they were that hard to learn, would this gang really know the playbook? It's the same sort of thing, but there's some trick to learning those things. I can't take, Jennifer Lawrence, though, I just heard her interviewed on Howard Stern, says she'll read the script once when she signs on to do something, but then puts it away until it's time to shoot, and she goes over it in the makeup chair because she wants the lines fresh.
It's her process. I mean, listen, I've worked with actors. The great Jimmy Simpson. I don't know if you watched Westworld.
Sure.
He was in House of Cards. He was the hacker in House of Cards. He was on my show Breakout Kings.
He's great.
He's an incredible
in fact,
actor.
And he did you. He participated in your little short film. Yes. Your one scene.
One scene from my book.
Short that you did that was fantastic. Yeah. It's really great.
Wow,
he's
you actually watched that?
Yeah, he's dynamite.
Would you watch that recently in preparation for this? Or?
That's right. I do my homework
before
I sit down with my subjects.
Well, thank you. He's an he's an incredible actor, Jimmy. And Jimmy's one of those actors where I don't say you could. Always Sunny in Philadelphia. I could say you could, but the truth is I have written for him almost an entire page monologue. And I write it without a care in the world because Jimmy's going to memorize it. Jimmy's going to know it, and Jimmy's going to act the bejesus out of it. And there are certain actors you can do that for. Other actors have a harder time. As long as you get the pieces and you can cut it together, it's fine. You knew your stuff. Every once in a while, there was one or two where you flubbed a little bit and you would go, oh, sorry. I don't know if you even heard me because you may have been so nervous. I was like, it's okay, man. Just do it again. We've got all the time in the world. And we did. We were fine. It cut together great. You look great. And again, I told you, in about 20 minutes, I got to go down the street to playback. If you want to come and watch yourself on a movie
screen. I want to do it, but again, fatherhood beckons. But I had plans to do it until about 45 minutes before we sat down here to begin. I appreciate
it. Well, family always comes first.
But, I did, walking in there, yeah, I mean, I was nervous, sure. It was a Hollywood set. It was a foreign thing for me. And then the great Catherine McPhee walks in. And was I nervous, as we started our scene work? Sure I was. I mean, she's an international celebrity. But Kat took some chances.
Here we go.
And that encouraged me to do the same. And really, you were great, Nick, but Kat gave me a playground. And... I ran with it. I feel silly getting too deep in the weeds because I know that Eddie and Emma don't understand show business the way you and I do. But I mean, it was exciting. That's why I got That's why acting has been my chief passion
for two weeks now.
I can remember. I remember as a kid growing up. My favorite thing with actors is when they say, "When did you know you wanted to be an actor?" When I was a kid, we loved playing cowboys and Indians in the backyard, and I knew right then I wanted to be an actor. Wow, that's real. Oh, wait, you had fun playing a game in the backyard? Differentiates you from everybody else you
Why
were playing.
So cynical?
Well, because I think that's a silly thing to bring up.
Maybe they enjoyed becoming the cowboys and the Indians more than the other kids. Maybe they gave their cowboy a backstory.
But you know what? To the point about – and then we'll wrap it up. But the point about the need to write, whether you're in the mood to every day, and that's really the trick. And in fact, it's not a trick. It's
work. It's a job.
It's working
job.
Out. You want to have a big bicep, lift the dumbbell over and over again every day without fail. You want to be a writer, write every day. That makes sense. But I think that in the 21st century, I think in the last decade or so, more than certainly any time before, it's exposed all the frauds. L.A., show business, whatever, for all the weird perceptions the society at large has about everybody's a phony out there. Everybody's a creep out there. Like, well, first of all, people in charge of any industry are creepy. You know, the people, there will always be a percentage of people who are running things, whatever industry it is, who will abuse that power. That's one thing. Personally, I've been lucky, I would say, that some of the greatest people I've ever known are these people, and I guess that makes sense. They're smart, they're funny people, of course, they're fun to hang out with. I think that the old cliche is that every waiter, every bartender has a screenplay ready to hand you to do that. I think you've kind of been exposed. If you are somebody who claims, I moved out here because I want to be in, it's always been my dream to be a writer. What have you written? Well, show us some stuff here. I want to be a director. I want to make movies. Like, hey, I don't know if you heard, your cell phone can make a movie now. You have no excuse. I think it's kind of removed all the people who wanted a life of whimsy after they tried being a lawyer, in my case, in sales. I don't know, may as well go to Hollywood and try being a comedy writer because I don't like doing this stuff.
What did you sell?
I don't know. I don't remember.
Hi.
Yep.
I have got dictionaries.
It didn't go well.
Ding dong.
I didn't like it. I didn't like doing it. It was.
Buy my Mario Lemieux lithograph.
I wasn't going door to door with a vacuum cleaner. I was going to 5,000 plus companies trying to sell them group benefit packages.
Insurance?
That's right.
You were an insurance salesman.
United Healthcare.
When Doug Drabeck threw out his arm, he had this exact plan. This is the one you want.
I didn't like it because people say, oh, you talk a lot, Dave. Yeah, but I always feel bad when it's time to ask people, like, so are we going to have business together? It's why I'm bad with women. Like, you know, like, yeah, I can talk your ear off, but to presume that anyone wants to keep business with me in one sense or another, that feels presumptuous on my part. So I could never ask people, like, so we gonna do this deal or what?
You know? How many times in a sales pitch did you bring up the Pittsburgh Maulers?
I got in
and
trouble.
And Mike Rozier destroying his career by going into the USFL.
I once, a surprisingly high amount of time,
yes,
that I talked about that. Well, of course, I was going to talk to these. I was in Chicago. I talked to them about Chicago sports.
Oh, you were in Chicago at the time?
I was in Chicago, so I would be talking to them about their Chicago sports.
Oh, my gosh. You just go in there and you'd be like, you know, Henry Cotto, utility outfielder for the 87 Cubs. I don't think he ever got his due as an outfielder.
Did you see Glenn Allen Hill where he landed that ball out on Waveland the other day? That was the way I would
Glenn Allen Hill.
I would get by. But
he
yes,
had a cup of coffee with the Yankees.
I got in trouble though once because we were at some high level meeting with these execs with whatever company, and we were at this fancy seafood place, and my boss said something about the fish that I got is delicious, oh this is really good, and I reached over and took a bite from his plate, and then afterwards I was reprimanded.
You like, ate off his plate?
That was inappropriate. That's a business meeting, and you reached over and ate
that
off
is
my
inappropriate
plate. Was it inappropriate? I'm a human being. He's sitting there bragging about how delicious his food is.
Yeah, his food.
I had to find out if he was right.
Let me tell you
something.
Turns
out he wasn't wrong, but as usual, I ordered the best.
If you and I are having a meal together,
yeah,
which now is highly unlikely,
okay,
I'm just checking. I made a mistake. He did play. Henry Cotto did play for the Cubs. I'm checking right now. Very briefly. But, okay, so I was right. If we were having a meal together and your fork started making approach for my plate, I would prong you right in the thumb, right in the meat between the thumb and the forefinger. How dare you touch someone else's niblets?
Ah, imagine living in my home. That's the price. That's the cost.
Oh, it's gross. You put your dirty, germ-covered fork in someone else's
Apple didn't fall
vittles?
Far from Mo Damashek's tree. Mo Damashek used to always take our milkshakes and have the first sip, and her excuse was that she had to make sure it wasn't poison.
Yeah, there you go.
She was willing to perish. To save us from a poisoned milkshake.
Wonderful mother.
She never really explained why the diner waitress had it in for us that they were going to poison us to death. I don't know why they what was in her mind. But either way, Nick Santor, what a pleasure. Just the tip of the iceberg, I feel like. We could go on on for hours and hours and hours.
These still waters do not run very deep.
What do you think? Should we – MVP, Eddie Spaghetti, let's take a vote. What do you think? Should he be back on the show?
We have plenty of things to cover. We have the Giants draft upcoming.
Right,
his,
okay.
His thoughts on, facing King Henrik Lundqvist, the Yankee season now with Judd and Stan, plenty of stuff to
Well, wait
to
a second.
About.
Neither one of your hockey and teams is going to even be playing in a couple
know,
of weeks.
I just want to know overall his thoughts because you always make fun of me for loving Henrik Lundqvist. And then, obviously, the review
Lundqvist
of –
Lundqvist is an excellent
he's
hockey
fine.
Player.
He's
the
fine.
Review of you on Scorpion as well.
He's fine because but the thing with King Henry is that he has, when he puts his pads on, he fills 98% of the goal. I guess I would stop a lot of pucks too.
That's like, Christian Okoye shouldn't have played running back because he was too big to stop going through the line. It's how he's physically featured.
It's an indictment of every goalie. The pads are ridiculous. To compare any goalie right now to Patrick Waugh and the relatively slight padding that he had is.
Or the great Billy Smith.
Smith, filthy. How can you? I mean, how he's dirty so, can a goalie be? People talk about Ron Hextall being dirty. Billy Smith is the filthiest goalie I've ever seen.
He was the greatest clutch goaltender in the history of the game.
Ugh. Oh, I mean, just one after the other.
Playoffs would start. He'd turn the switch.
I hated every single one of those guys. Anders Hed. What was it? Anders.
Anders Hedberg was on the Rangers. You're thinking of Mats Helin, number 20, who came in after. Gord Lane, yeah. Former Washington Capitol, number 24. I can name the whole team in numerical order, probably.
All right, before we wrap it, then, I think we really should do that. An American hero, Kenny Morrow.
Kenny Morrow, number 6. It starts with number 2, Gord Dineen, number 3, Thomas Johnson. Paul Boudelier, number 5. Thomas Johnson. Thomas Johnson, so good, he played left wing some games, even though he's a defenseman. Then we go 5, Dennis Potvin, 6, Morrow, 7, the great underrated Stefan Pearson, 8, Patrick Flatley, also Gary Howitt before he left the team, 9, Clark Gillies, 10, Lorne Henning,
couple
who
of
had
Sutters,
the assist.
12 and 21.
Well, 11. Center of the famed banana line, Wayne Merrick, between Tinelli and Nystrom. 12, Dwayne Sutter. 13, Steve Tambellini, father of current NHL player Tambellini. 14, the incredible Bob Boardman, the famous end-to-end rush against the Blue Shirts, which you know that goal. 16, Pat LaFontaine, who came for the drive for 5 and didn't get it. 7, the red-headed rocket, Greg Gilbert. 18, the captain, Eddie Westfall, who left before they started winning. Do you want to hear the rest of them?
I love it. I don't know. These guys, they get very upset. I can do the same sorts of tricks with local teams, and I can also run off every NFL, every Super Bowl MVP and what the score was and what the
but
game
I
was
But I have
like.
To finish now
and
because
I start
started.
To do it, and then they this is getting boring. I'm boring my
Wait, how old?
My whiz,
your,
my,
your
my
combined
knowledge?
Ages are less than my current age. We're not going to listen to anything they say.
That's true.
All right, keep going. Number 9, the greatest center of his day, Brian Trottier. Guy was absolutely incredible. 20, Mats Helin, who I believe got a ring for the fourth
I
cup.
Didn't – you know what? When Brian Trottier made way to Pittsburgh, PA, to play in the igloo at the,
it's
in the twilight of his
excellent, incredible
career,
hockey player.
A lot of people cheered him in Pittsburgh before he even took
oh,
one
Oh, you
shift.
Booed him? You booed your own
I
player?
Didn't, I didn't boo him. I said, you know what? I'm going to let bygones be bygones. What's done is done.
He won multiple cups with
I
you.
I can't take those cups away from him. I can't take away the emotional pain he inflicted on me as a child. I'm not going to boo him, but shame the devil if I'm going to cheer for Brian Trottier right now until he does something for my team. I held out, and I had my dignity, and I put it into that first cup he delivered. I drank it right down.
There you go. He helped you win. He delivered.
That's fine. He was a third-line mucker. He was okay.
He
By
was
then,
excellent.
He was Right, he was good.
Yes, and a leader on the ice. And then we have 21, Brent Sutter, 22, Mike Bossy, 23, the great Bob Nystrom, 24, Gord Lane, 25, penalty killer extraordinaire, Billy Carroll, 26, out of Minnesota, Dave Langevin, 27, John Tinelli, unceremoniously traded for Steve Conroy and Rich Crom from the Calgary Flames.
Is that right?
Terrible
oh,
trade.
Oh, that's right. Tinelli went up to Calgary.
Yes,
I forgot about
and,
that.
And Conroy was a good player, but, man, I mean, come on. 29 was Hector Marini, but he left. 30, Kelly Rudy. 31, Billy Smith. All the way up to 91, Butch Goring. I may have skipped over someone accidentally.
You know who you skipped? With on purpose, I imagine.
Dwayne Sutter at 12.
The man who would periodically go between the pipes to face the lowly Pittsburgh Penguins, and the whole igloo would go, Raleigh Melanson.
Raleigh Melanson, number one. I started at number two. I started at number two, Gord Dineen. Raleigh the goalie, who they brought in, Raleigh the goalie, in game five, Al Arbor with the great play. We used to get 2 minutes to warm up the goaltender. They brought him in and blah, blah, blah. I love that team.
I hate it, and then 11 years later, the Penguins have the perfect reckoning lined up for them. They're down 3-1 to the upstart New York Islanders. Penguins, not the Islanders, have won two straight cups. The Islanders roll into Pittsburgh for a decisive Game 7. Inexplicably, the Islanders go up 3-1 with a minute to go in the game, and the Penguins rally, score, force the overtime. And I remember standing outside in the igloo before that overtime and saying, I mean, the sports gods have got to come through here. They heard us in 1982. We could have disrupted the dynasty. Now it's our time to make good on that. The Pens will win their third straight cup. Instead, David Volek scored. I was in the igloo that night.
You know where I was that night? I was watching the game with Bernie Federko. If I can tell you two other things. I forgot number 28, Anders Kaller. Great penalty killer.
That's who I was thinking of.
And the first team ever, this is going to hurt, it's going to make me feel good, first team ever to win a series in the NHL after being down 3-0. The New York Islanders won 4 straight against
1975
the Pittsburgh Penguins.
That reminds me of
But people don't realize the next series, the Islanders were down 3-0, won the next 3, and lost a Game 7.
That's right.
They almost did it 2 series in a row.
And that was against the Rangers, wasn't it? No, that was against the Flyers. No, that reminds me a lot of when you mentioned that, it reminds me of 2004, the greatest baseball team to ever play ball, the New York Yankees. They were up 3-0 on this pathetic bunch from Boston.
What are you bringing that up for?
You're not because you just
you're not a Red Sox
Penguins
fan
because you feel
that
like it's your
is,
place.
That's childish.
Do you see what he does? That like, is a nice guy.
You know something? You're just a
hey,
baby.
Hey, Sal, get me on speakerphone so Jimmy can hear me.
I didn't. By the way, I didn't call Jimmy up. Sal called me.
I want
you
every.
Did
I want
that to be your petulant
and Barbieri. I want all the high ticket
Barbieri.
I want them all on the phone. Rosner. I want
That's
them all
what
on
happened.
The phone. So
I don't even know who's Rosner.
Rick Rosner.
I never met him.
The nude guy. You don't know Rick Rosner?
No, I do not. I'm not in that circle. I just watch football
Rick
once every couple of weeks.
Never would come over to watch football. You're right.
Let me tell you something. I'm watching your guys here, your team, Spaghetti and Emma. They're getting bored, but they don't like you, man. When you yell at me like that, they get mad at you. They like me.
Yeah.
That was a totally unnecessary shot to bring up the socks.
To bring up the socks.
Like, why is
the podcast is going really well, and you just
thank you, Spaghetti.
Unnecessary. Yeah. He worked in a jab at 1975.
Because we were talking
which
about
shows
hockey.
His age because I don't even remember 1975.
Well, I was 4 years old, but I remember the game quite well.
Good for you. Creep. All right, listen. Still, I think it's break even because you did call me 8 or 10 months ago. I never got the message.
You never called me back, I swear to God.
I never got the message.
I was getting so mad. All right. We'll let it go.
All right. So are we on for a recurring role?
I have to be at playback for your episode in 6.5 minutes.
All right. You can go, but after you answer, does this mean that I'm probably going to be a recurring character?
Yeah, we're going to have to work out your contract with CBS.
So 26 episodes I'll have to be free? We're going to have to work around that. I got some other responsibilities, but we got to figure that out.
Legitimately going to be late for work if we don't wrap this up. two guys want to come watch, if you want to sit through the process, see what it's like, you can. Dave's too busy with his family, and I get that.
I got to see Dave's acne at you.
All right.
Nick Santora, what a pleasure to keep this with you. And now it turns out, talk about recurring. You're a recurring guest on the DDFP. Let's talk to him either before or just after the draft and see what your sense is on the
If you want to hear me ramble, I'd be happy.
I love it. All right, Pally, we appreciate it. Nick Santora, and again, 10 p.m. CBS, Monday night.
The 26th of March is your episode.
The Scorpion with
not the Scorpion, just Scorpion.
Scorpion with Catherine McPhee.
There you go. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.